This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview attorney Mara Verheyden Hilliard from the D.C. civil rights firm Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
Here's a woman that combines good politics and extremely sharp legal skills and has racked up a string of victories.
The United Nations Human Rights Council investigated and sent a fact-finding mission into the 2010 Israeli lethal attacks of ships traveling to Gaza.
This scandalizes the murderous Israeli government like they were scandalized on their attack on Gaza quite a while ago. But the United States government has dismissed it.
We'll talk about the deepening human rights crisis in Honduras more than a year after the June 2009 military coup.
Remember the death squads under Ronald Reagan in the 80s in Central America? Well, they're cooked up again under Obama in Honduras.
Stay with us. Today, we're joined by attorney Mara Verheyden Hilliard, co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Legal Defense and Education Fund, in the second part of our Lawyers You'll Like series. Mara and her partner Carl Marcinio have worked to defend and advance fundamental civil, constitutional, and human rights secured by the United States Constitution. Today, we talk about her work and the criminalizing of dissent, surveillance, data mining, and FBI harassment. A lot of Mara's work is at the intersection of First and Fourth Amendment rights, such as the assault on free speech, assembly, and the misuse of data mining tools. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has had many victories over the past few years, most recently securing the largest settlement in United States history for protesters who were abused by police in the District of Columbia. Mara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, over the past few years, and especially the past few months, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has had some truly landmark victories, especially in the areas of protecting the right to dissent, and you had the Checkpoints case in D.C. We've talked about some of these over the past years, but we really wanted to find out how you got into this type of work. Tell us a bit about your background and how you came to do specifically the protest-related cases.
Well, as you said, I co-founded the Partnership for Civil Justice, and that was in 1994 with Carl Marcinio. And we decided that we wanted to do this type of work, specifically constitutional rights, economic justice, public interest litigation, in a particular way. And we didn't see other opportunities existing out there to do really what we very much felt needed to be done and what we wanted to do. So we began this work and this organization right after we left law school. We undertook some of the longest-running protest cases that we've had, in particular the recently settled class action from the April 2000 mass arrests in 2000. So that's a 10-year-long case. And we became involved in that case, in fact, working with other National Lawyers Guild attorneys and law students and legal workers.
Mara, where'd you go to law school?
I went to Columbia Law School in New York.
And were you political before you went to law school?
Oh, yes.
Where'd you get your politics?
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I spent my childhood going to civil rights demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, having our house filled with demonstrators. Both of my parents were are deeply political people who care very much about civil rights and liberation struggles and women's rights. And I was fighting these issues in my elementary school, in fact. And after college, I went to Hampshire College. After that, I worked doing women's rights work before I went to law school. And I chose to go to law school specifically because there were issues I wanted to fight and things I wanted to do that I felt I wanted a law degree to be able to do them.
Yeah, but how did you feel about law school?
I think, honestly, that law school is at least 2 years too long. And I think that people should be able to get a law degree and become practicing lawyers, particularly if they want to be people's lawyers, by going to law school to, you know, learn the basics, but then being able to actually do the work. Because I think that the best education that I had was actually doing the work, was the time that I spent in law school being able to intern and clerk for different organizations and to see practical day-to-day nuts and bolts litigation.
Now, Mara, you're known for your litigation. Tell us what your approach is in terms of not compromising, for example, protesters' rights and values.
Well, the core of the work that we do, we recognize is the underlying social justice movements and what their ultimate goals are for human liberation. And when we take on a case, a free speech case, for example, we're looking not just at a technical violation of the First Amendment, not just merely that someone's rights have been violated and that, you know, as important and critical it is as we stand to defend the Bill of Rights, that also that there are larger issues and that we want to keep the streets open and the sidewalks open and the parkland open because all social change, all historical change in the United States that has made a difference for people has come from below. It has come from popular movements and popular struggle, not because the politicians decide to give people rights, but because there is that feeling that the people are demanding them and that they're going to force it to happen. So that at the end of the day, we don't see the issue being just, do we get a judge on the bench to agree with us and that's it? It's also making sure that there is space for people to be able to express themselves. So in that way, we turn to our clients again and again to make sure that we are working both with our clients and with community organizations in service of their ultimate struggles.
And in fact, you're reminding me of Arthur Kanoy, longtime guild member who was a sort of a hero of many guild members.
Of many of us.
And in fact, that's what Arthur told legions of law students and young lawyers is that you have to listen to the people you're serving. We take their message from them. And so often traditional attorneys will advise clients in a certain way. But I think that you and Carl and the partnership really are fabulous listeners.
Oh, thank you.
And knowing that these cases do take, as you say, upwards of 10 years and even more, I would suppose that many attorneys might be tempted to take shortcuts. Can you give some pointers for how you hang in there for the long haul in this kind of case?
Well, first of all, I have to say that we have fabulous plaintiffs and clients. We are so honored to be able to work with people who are absolutely committed to the underlying issues, the issues that they went on the streets for to begin with, and then the issues that arise in the context of litigation. So that in these cases, for example, these two long-running mass arrest cases that we've been litigating, one since 2000, one since 2002, that we've recently settled in the past year, these cases, our clients said to us whenever we communicated with them that their ultimate goal was to make sure that what happened to them never happened to anyone else. In both these cases, there's more than 1,000 people, class members that we're representing, who were engaged in peaceful protest in Washington, D.C., and the police came in and surrounded them and swept people off the streets, took parents and their children, separating them, took protesters, took bystanders, tourists, held them on buses in punitive, abusive conditions with their hands tied up behind them, and then took them to like a police gym floor where they were hogtied and people were tied up wrist to ankle in stress and duress positions for more than 24 hours, unable to extend their backs. Oh. And the sadism and cruelty of this is, you know, extreme, coming from the police department and ratified by the municipality. But all of our clients wanted to fight these cases out to make sure that we could change the landscape in D.C. And that's what we set out to do, and that's what the fight goes on so long for. Because I think that, you know, the municipalities, the governments, they want these cases to go on as long as possible. They want to fight a war of attrition because they want plaintiffs to feel like they have to take toothless settlements and walk away with, you know, little that they've accomplished. And they want to make it hard for them to find attorneys who are willing to stay and fight for the decade that it takes. And we were willing to do that. Our clients are willing to do that. And so, for example, in D.C., it has changed here. I mean, not to say that we don't think, you know, with an upsurge of social justice movements, the police won't violate the law again in some way, and we'll be in court that day. But the fact is, right now, the law has changed in D.C. We have training in place. We've changed the way the police operate. They can't use these tactics. These specific tactics that we took apart piece by piece have been removed from the arsenal of the police department in D.C.
Mara, can you talk specifically about the changes, and I believe the city council was involved in this process, in 2004, I think, to the manual that the police use for how they treat demonstrators?
Well, there were two elements of change. In a number of our cases, we've had more than those two mass arrest cases, and in a series of cases we've brought over the past decade, we have, as part of equitable relief in our cases, gotten changes in the police mass demonstration manual, in their training programs, their requirements. But as well, there was a change in the law, which goes beyond the manual, which in 2004 and took effect in 2005, which is the First Amendment Rights and Police Standards Act. And that law specifically actually tracked the demands we were making in our cases so that, for example, the police can't just throw up these pop-up police lines and surround demonstrators and stop a demonstration, not allow people to leave, arrest them. They can't use that trap and detain, trap and arrest tactic. They can't hold people for long periods of time. If people are arrested in D.C. for, you know, basic nonviolent offenses in the context of First Amendment activity, they have to be let out 4 hours now if they're arrested by the D.C. police. They cannot use that wrist-to-ankle handcuffing mechanism against people anymore. And there are a number of other provisions like that. The police have to have their badges plainly available and visible. They can't come out in riot gear to First Amendment assemblies, which, you know, make assemblies look like they're criminal activity when, in fact, it's cherished free speech activity.
And also ratchets up the feeling, the palpable feeling of fear among protesters.
Yes, and it's an effort to demonize the protesters, one, to send a chill to protesters, but the other, to send a message to everyone else that might think, you know, I care about this issue, I want to go out and I want to stand up for what I believe in, but then you look at it and you think, maybe it's dangerous. It shouldn't appear to be dangerous to go out and speak your mind.
We've seen in the last few weeks an upswing in FBI visits to activists' homes, raids, issuing of subpoenas to appear before grand juries. And you're certainly aware, because you've been involved in the Republican and Democratic National Convention, with uniform approach, we see this kind of FBI intimidation. Do you think this is getting worse?
I think that this effort, this round of subpoenas and raids of the last 2 weeks ago, is a dramatic escalation from the FBI. The question of worse is really a question of who's being targeted. Since 2001, obviously being a Muslim in the United States or Arab American has been basically to wear a target when it comes to federal law enforcement, local law enforcement often. And there have been raids going on and subpoenas and attacks on the Arab and Muslim community, you know, throughout the United States to an extreme. Now we're seeing this effort against solidarity activists with the raids and subpoenas, and during the month of October there are, you know, grand juries that are being convened. It remains to see what happens, and it remains to see whether or not this is going to expand, and also what the origin and the breadth of this initial effort is. Obviously, there were attacks like this on the solidarity movement in the 80s with, for example, the attacks against CISPIS. So I think that people are trying to get a good assessment of what's going on. I think it is outrageous. I think it is baseless for the government to be coming in and targeting people engaged in solidarity work. But I think it's also reflective of the huge security apparatus that is put in place in the U.S. under Bush and is being accelerated under Obama. And I think Obama has responsibility, and his Justice Department has responsibility for the fact that they have not made one effort in the time that they've been in office to try and step back from the Bush-era security apparatus, and they're not going to, and we didn't think that they would.
Well, Mara, that you anticipated my next question. I didn't think they would either. But what do you say to a young person who got active politically, say, for the first time in Pennsylvania or Ohio, getting people out to vote for Obama, getting on the website of Move On, sending money into Obama, thinking that the pendulum is going to swing back now from where it was under Bush and Cheney and Ashcroft to a better place, and this hasn't happened. How do you explain in a more profound way to people, you know, why this hasn't happened, why you thought it would not happen, and where you're coming from?
Well, we didn't think that there would be a major shift in some of these key issues. And I think, in fact, we talked about that on this show just before Obama took office, around the time he was taking office, which was really going to be a question of whether or not the Obama administration was going to expend political capital on these issues when it's not the core of their political beliefs anyway to be in opposition to the security state. And, in fact, they have not been. They have ramped it up. And they are clearly not going to be making any efforts and have not in ongoing litigation or just in the general day-to-day policy efforts coming from the Obama administration to step back or alter that. I think the issue for people that came out that were engaged, that were so enthusiastic and so hopeful for that administration, is that those beliefs, that hope, that thought that you can change the direction of the country that you live in is absolutely true. It is 100% absolutely true. All you need to do is look at the history of the United States for the past 100 years, 150 years, and you look at the struggles over and over again where at a point in time people would have thought slavery could not end. People would have thought women would not get the right to vote. You would have thought that you would not have been able to get an 8-hour day, that there would be trade unions, that the civil rights struggles, all of those things have happened because people were in the streets, because people cared, because they came out, because they mobilized, because they had energy. So every single person that was out there working for Obama or signing up on Move On, you know, for the Democratic Party, should really go back to the core of what sent them out to begin with and think about finding the groups and the organizations that actually are in the streets to make change. And recognize that it's no fault to hope and to think that an elected official is going to do it, but historically an elected official has never been the one to do it. Elected officials act to the extent they act when they feel that there is nearly a revolution coming. I mean, if you think about the 1964 and 1965, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Congress that passed that was the same Dixiecrat Congress that was in existence 10 years earlier. So the politicians hadn't changed. What had changed was the mood of the country and the feeling of the people in the streets.
I was heartened to see, Mara, in response to the recent raids, that there were a lot of grassroots mobilizations, a lot of rallies. People don't seem to be taking this
sitting down.
Whenever the government does something like this, obviously it has an impact, and you know, and it causes a wake, and people, you know, have a reaction. But the important reaction is to stand up to it, and the important reaction is for people to come together and stand in solidarity, and to find that right balance. You don't want to be so over the top that there's sort of a, you know, hysterical element to things, because you don't really know the scope of anything, and you've got to be able to assess what's going on. But you have to take seriously what's happened. It's a huge burden on the people that are under attack. It, you know, it ties them up in litigation. It puts their liberty interests at stake. And at the same time, people have to be able to recognize what something is, and that, you know, the government is in the service of the people. And that if the government is going to take action like this, the people can get together and stand up and fight back against that.
You've had so many really tremendous successes in the area of First Amendment rights. What of all your cases stands out as sort of the one you're most proud of?
You know, that's really hard to say, and I think it's because we look at things cumulatively in a way. Again, going back to the idea that it's not a particular ruling or a particular moment. It's the aggregate impact. So that when we look at like the past 10 years in D.C., the reality was that there was a period of years here in 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, that when you came to Washington for certain demonstrations and, you know, militant political activity, lawful, peaceful, but, you know, vibrant political activity in the streets, you were at real risk that by merely coming out and engaging in lawful activities, you were going to end up in a trap and detain situation, yanked off the street, and thrown in detention. And that is no longer the case. That, along with, you know, these other tactics, the issue of the brutality that was going on, we were able to find in our litigation, we were stunned to find that use of force reporting requirements had been quietly suspended by the chief of police in the context of mass demonstrations, which basically was telling the cops, like, you have a green light to go beat people up because you don't even have to report it. And when we found that out, you know, we were able to change that. We were able to change the training, to change the rules on that. And that's had an impact in terms of the issues of brutality against demonstrators. But now, too, we look at this in the larger context of police brutality and police misconduct against everyone in D.C., not merely the demonstrators. I mean, we know that if the police are doing that here and they're doing that in high-profile cases, you know, we know what they're doing to every single, you know, person that may just get attacked by the police in D.C. And so we look at the larger scope as well.
Mara, what advice do you have for young lawyers who want to work on behalf of social justice?
I really want to urge people, and particularly law students and young lawyers who are thinking about doing this kind of work, the most important thing is to do it, is not to try and worry about external factors like, you know, am I getting the highest grades, and, am I sort of achieving someone else's measure or standard of success. The thing is to look out there and see what needs to be done and use the tools at your disposal, the law degree that's at your disposal, to go out there and fight for justice and fight for people, because you can do it. You will be satisfied. You will have a fantastic career doing that. And for people that are not lawyers or law students that want to fight for social justice, you know, particularly on this issue of the Obama administration, everything in this country, everything in the world, it changes dynamically. And you often don't know the change before it happens, but you can be part of the change that makes it happen. And after it happens, everyone looks back and says, oh, well, that makes sense. Before it happens, as you look forward, sometimes it's hard to envision. The only way it will happen is if you're out there fighting for it. And everyone who has a heart and a conscience can do that.
Mara, I think those are fitting words on which to end. You indeed serve as a role model for many, you and Carl, and the fabulous work that you've done, and we'd like to thank you for that.
Thank you so much, and thank you for everything that both of you do.
Well, our gratitude and solidarity to you, Mara. You take it easy.
You too.
Bye-bye. A United Nations fact-finding mission into the May 31, 2010 Israeli lethal attacks of ships traveling to Gaza has reported that Israeli forces violated international law, quote, including international humanitarian and human rights law. 8 Turkish activists and 1 Turkish American were killed in the raid on board the ships attempting to break the Gaza blockade. The UN Human Rights Council's investigation judged Israel's naval blockade of the Palestinian territory to be, quote, unlawful, because there was a humanitarian crisis in Gaza at the time. However, the United States criticized what it termed as the report's, quote, unbalanced language, tone, and conclusions. The Center for Constitutional Rights, the Free Gaza Movement, and the National Lawyers Guild responded to the report and the comments made by the United States at the council. Quote, unfortunately, the United States used the opportunity of the Human Rights Council's decision on the Flotilla Fact-Finding Mission's report to promote its political agenda, instead of engaging on the issue of legal accountability for Israel's illegal blockade of Gaza and the unlawful attack on the Gaza flotilla, said CCR attorney Catherine Gallagher. She continued, the U.S. must recognize that there can be no peace without justice, and that until it supports accountability for violations of international law, even when violations committed by Israel, instead of a culture of impunity, it lacks the legitimacy necessary to serve as a broker of peace. We are joined by Catherine Gallagher today. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have another attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights, Katie. You just came back from Geneva. You heard the report on the Gaza flotilla. Can you just give us in a nutshell what the flotilla was trying to accomplish, what the Israeli Navy did to them, and then let's talk about the report from the UN.
Sure. The Gaza flotilla, which was headed towards Gaza in May of this past year, there were 6 civilian ships, and their goal was to both bring humanitarian aid to Gaza, which has been under a naval blockade by Israel for the last now 4 years, as well as to challenge the nature of that blockade and the legality of that blockade. As those ships were headed towards Gaza, they were attacked in international waters in what is probably a quite well-known attack, particularly on the Mavi Marmara, by Israeli commandos, which resulted in the death of 9 civilian passengers.
And as a result, the United Nations sent a fact-finding mission to look at these attacks and has just issued a report. Tell us briefly about the report and who was involved in putting it together.
The United Nations Human Rights Council, back in June, soon after the attack, set up a fact-finding mission. And over the course of the summer, the three commissioners traveled to London, to Geneva, to Istanbul, and to Jordan to interview passengers on the flotilla, as well as meeting with legal experts and other experts to analyze the evidence they heard. And essentially what happened last week is that the Human Rights Council's fact-finding mission presented its report, and it set forth in 56 very detailed pages precisely what happened on those ships on the night of May 31st. It set the stage through looking at the blockade and concluded that the blockade is illegal under international law. It found that the six humanitarian ships that were traveling to Gaza to break the blockade presented no imminent threat to the Israelis, that the amount of force used to stop the flotilla from going to Gaza was disproportionate, that lethal force should never have been used, that there were far less extreme measures that the Israelis could have taken rather than having commandos land on a passenger ship in the middle of the night opening fire.
You were in Geneva and heard the report delivered. Give us the background of the three commissioners that investigated that for us, will you please?
Sure. Well, the three commissioners have long experience in international law matters. One had been a judge on the International Criminal Court. One had been the chief of prosecutions at the Special Court for Sierra Leone. And the third had been a commissioner on various human rights bodies within the UN. So they have extensive experience looking at human rights violations. Their conclusions are grounded very much in law and not in kind of political conclusions, as some have expressed concern.
Now, the Israelis have said that their men were attacked and they were only defending themselves. What does the commission say to that Israeli allegation?
I mean, the commission recognizes what is out there on the film of Yara Lee, which is that you had civilian passengers who were not armed when they boarded those ships. And when Israeli commandos were coming down off of helicopters in the middle of the night, they armed themselves with the few things that they could, such as a slingshot, a piece of metal piping from the ship. But they were not armed with any weapons that they had brought onto the ships. They were peaceful protesters who were preparing for an attack on the ship in the middle of the night by armed commandos.
Katie, the United States has criticized what it terms as the report's, quote, unbalanced language, tone, and conclusions. Speak to that momentarily.
It's hard to see what they find as unbalanced. I think the report is very carefully written. It's cautiously written, beginning with its analysis of its own mandate. When the Human Rights Council set forth what the investigation was supposed to look into, it used the word attack and it used the word violations. And the commissioners were very clear that they were starting with a blank slate. They were going to decide whether it was attack, they were going to decide whether there were violations. So it's a very, very carefully drafted report. The unbiased nature of it is, at best, that it concluded that, yes, there were violations of international law in setting forth a blockade against the civilian population of Gaza. There were violations of international law in opening an armed attack on civilian passenger ships in the middle of the night, that the use of lethal force against civilians, unarmed civilians, was a violation of international law, that this was an unnecessary, a disproportionate, an excessive, and an inappropriate attack. That was based on the factual findings of the commission.
Go into it, if you will, what happened to the people that were taken off. The ships was out in international waters, 65 miles away from land, and the people were taken to Israel. And I understand from hearing at the panel that their personal belongings were confiscated, that they were abused. I read one incident of a doctor, and the Israeli soldiers tried to break his fingers. What happened to the people that were taken off the ship?
The bulk of the passengers were then detained in Israel at detention sites that had already been established. So, I mean, this shows that the Israelis were preparing to take over those ships and preparing to bring the passengers to Israel. And they were held for anywhere from 24 to 72 hours. There were many instances where people complained about the amount of time before they were able to speak with a consular official. And the report documents incidents of people being beaten, people being stripped, a great deal of harassment. And then, of course, the passengers were deported from Israel, even though in their minds they had never wanted to enter Israel in the first place. In terms of the property, this is an area of great concern. And I just want to clarify, it's not because of the value of the property in and of itself, but it's also because of what that property consists of. It consists of cameras, computer chips, video equipment. It contains electronic equipment that provides firsthand evidence of the flotilla passengers, their activities, and then the attack on the ship. And for the past 4 months, Israel has been in sole possession of that material.
Well, one wonders if they have destroyed it.
Well, yes. And that was something CCR, along with other organizations, very soon after the attack, sent an open letter to the State Department asking what steps it was taking to ensure that the evidence was being preserved and would not be destroyed. The U.S. passengers have, in fact, just sent a letter to the State Department today raising concerns about the fact that their property has not been returned, that they've received very little support from the State Department. They've raised concerns about the destruction of evidence, and most importantly, they've raised concerns about what the State Department has done to investigate the death, the murder of U.S. citizen Furkan Dogan.
Katie, is there any evidence that remains to document this?
Well, we do have firsthand testimonies, of course, from the witnesses. We have the autopsy reports, and there are some computer or video chips that have come off the ship that people were able to smuggle off.
Katie, I wanted to ask you how our listeners can get a hold of the UN report on the Gaza flotilla attack.
Sure, that would be on the High Commissioner for Human Rights website. If they do a Google search of fact-finding mission for Gaza and Human Rights Council, they should be able to find that. We also will have that report along with a legal analysis that we did on the CCR website if they go to our Gaza flotilla page, ccrjustice.org.
What do you think the results are going to be in the United States, Israel, and generally worldwide of the issuance of this report?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't seen enough discussion of the report here in the United States, but I think that there is a great deal of momentum that's been happening since the attack on the flotilla. And since, frankly, the blockade of Gaza has reached the proportions that it has, you know, which have been recognized as a form of collective punishment. So I think at least within the United States, those who are interested in what's happening in Gaza will continue to pressure for some real results. And that group starts with the U.S. passengers themselves, who, as I said, sent a letter to the State Department today. In Europe, there was quite a bit of interest in the report that was issued. The Human Rights Council will be doing some follow-up on this report. And, of course, then we wait for the Secretary General's report. And I think all of us need to ensure, in whatever ways we can, that there is accountability for what happened on the 31st of May when 9 civilians were killed.
What form would that accountability take?
Well, I think as the UN report sets out, there is both individual and state responsibility that needs to be allocated. So there are the individuals who were involved in creating the policies behind both the blockade, which was found illegal, and then organizing the attack on these civilian ships. You know, as we know, there were meetings in Israel in advance of the attack. So those who made the decision to allow the use of force against civilian vessels. Of course, there are the individuals who actually executed some of the passengers, killed some of the passengers. So I think there's individual accountability that needs to exist. And then there's state responsibility for the ongoing policy of the blockade and then what happened on those boats.
It's really been a pleasure to hear firsthand what CCR is doing about your trip to Geneva and your analysis. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. A human rights crisis continues to worsen in Honduras, more than 1 year after the June 28, 2009 military coup. People on the front lines who oppose the regime installed after the coup are beaten and illegally detained by the state. Nectali Rodesno, co-coordinator of National Front of Lawyers in Resistance Against the Coup in Honduras, is among the attorneys directly involved in defending those who are being abused and whose lives are on the line every day. To inform people about the ongoing crisis in Honduras, there will be a speaking tour this fall called Justice in Honduras, Witness for Peace, Mid-Atlantic Fall Speakers Tour. It will happen from November 1st to 22nd. We talk more about what's happening in Honduras with Pam Spies, Senior Staff Attorney in the International Human Rights Program at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She has a background in international criminal and human rights law with a gender focus, as well as a criminal trial practice. Pam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, we've been hearing a lot about some human rights violations occurring in Honduras. Can you briefly set up the scenario of what's happening and in what context?
Well, as you may know, the coup happened on June 28th of last year. And immediately from that moment on, you began to see a lot of repression and oppressive tactics taken against the resistance that formed pretty immediately after the coup. And that was a broad-based and very diverse coalescing of groups that came together and have strengthened over the past year. And even in the face of these abuses and the violence, you know, immediately leaders of that resistance were being targeted. There were several key people who were killed in the immediate aftermath of the coup.
When you say key people, what were their positions?
Well, Walter Troches is a good example. Walter was a key LGBT activist before the coup because they had been so organized, you know, before the coup. They were well-placed along with some of the women's groups, along women's human rights groups, to actually lead in the resistance, play leading roles in the resistance after the coup, as people were coming together and you know, trying to make sense of what was happening. And so Walter was playing a leading role in helping to coordinate those efforts. And he was targeted and he was killed in a very brutal way. Not
you have
long
any idea
after
who
the coup.
Killed him?
There's a lot of concern around the, obviously there's concern about the type of investigations that are being undertaken. At that time, you had the interim regime of Micheletti in place. It was before the elections, and the government's response, law enforcement's response to these killings are obviously very controversial and something the resistance is trying to raise. So you saw the targeting of leaders of the resistance, but then you also saw the targeting of leaders who, you know, labor leaders. Vanessa Cepeda was somebody who was gunned down after a meeting. And then you began to see in March, and now this was after the elections, which took place in November, and Porfirio Lobo takes office in January, and the killings continue, even in to this new sort of de facto administration. In March, you saw the targeting of journalists. I think in the month of March alone, about 8 journalists were killed.
How were the journalists killed?
What you tend to see is sort of drive-by shootings. There was one teacher who was killed in his school during, you know, working hours with students around, and that sort of folks on the ground feel like that mirrored the old sort of death squad activity, the way they came in, the masks, and gunning him down the way they did. So there are some similarities in these killings, but both the Micheletti regime and the Lobo regime, people associated with those regimes, will say that this is, due to criminal activity, that Honduras has a high crime rate, there's lots of drug activity. They'll say things and try to deflect from the likelihood that these are political killings.
Tell us a bit about the National Front of Lawyers in Resistance Against the Coup. Are you involved in that?
Well, we are at the Center for Constitutional Rights are looking, constantly looking for ways to work in solidarity with the resistance front in Honduras. And the lawyers are playing a key role in all of this because of the role the judiciary played in the coup and in helping to tee up the coup. The judiciary, in particular the Supreme Court, was taking certain steps before the coup to help undermine Zelaya and what he was doing, and all of that is centered around this poll he wanted to take of Hondurans to see if they were in support of a future constitutional assembly. Now, it was widely put out there that he was doing that to extend his term. That has subsequently been totally disproven. I mean, that was totally false, but that was that was sort of clouding this atmosphere, and I think there was a purposeful. I think what we know now is that was purposeful, and that they were using that as a red flag that is not actually what was going on in this referendum. But the Supreme Court was playing this role to delegitimize those steps he was taking.
Attorney Pam Spees from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Let me switch colors from red to green. Is it your belief that the United States gave the coup plotters the green light to go ahead? If so, what's the connection now between the current government and the United States?
Well, there are still a lot of questions surrounding exactly what happened. As you know, June of 2009 was 6 months into Obama's term. And what we do see is that there are a couple of key actors in all of this who have played important roles in past U.S. administrations, but who are now in the private sector. So, for instance, you have Otto Reich, who had been building up this corruption campaign around Zelaya.
Yeah, Otto Reich. My friend Randy Credico used to make the joke that Otto Reich had two brothers, and he was a third Reich.
Right. Well, Otto Reich had served under the Reagan administration. In the documents and in all of the information that came out during Iran-Contra, it became known that he had played a role in building propaganda around the U.S., around what was happening in Central America to help justify U.S. intervention. He goes on to work under the Bush administration and then more recently under George W. Bush, and was playing a role in Latin America at the time of the failed coup in Venezuela. So now he's now in the private sector and has a consulting firm and was really key in playing a really important role, I think, in terms of understanding the destabilization process that was going on before the coup. Raising these corruption allegations, which have yet to be proven as far as Zelaya. And it's, I think we're still learning the degree to which how much of what the U.S. was doing, or U.S. actors were doing, was driven by official administration policy, and how much of it was left over or held over from previous administrations and previous ways of looking at Central America.
Zelaya was himself a representative of the old establishment, and I think that he had suggested a couple of reforms that might have shifted the amount of money that the old ruling elites had kind of down to the general population. That was my understanding of why they tried to destabilize his government.
Yeah, I think that played a big role in all of this. I mean, what was happening during his term is that we had the international economic crisis, we had the mortgage crisis in the U.S., we had a financial crisis that was affecting food security. It was just making life much more difficult everywhere. And so he was trying to take steps to buffer the Hondurans against this. And one of the things he did was raise the minimum wage. And at the time, that was somewhat controversial among the business elite.
Raise it from what to what?
He raised it and he tied it to the food index so that people could eat. I mean, he didn't even, you know, he wasn't even able to raise it to a, taking into account all of the standards and all of the indicators, but he tied it to, he was able to justify it and sell it in Honduras by tying it to the food, the rising cost of food. There were a number of steps he was trying to take to help buffer Honduras against, you know, during this crisis and the storm that was raging. And he had also joined ALBA, which was very controversial, and the U.S., you know, successive U.S. administrations and have a harsh view of
ALBA. Explain what ALBA is.
ALBA is the Bolivarian Alternative for Latin America, which is an effort that sort of, you know, emerged from Venezuela, but to help create this, it's an economic plan that helps different Latin American countries with the purchase of oil and the supply of oil. And it offers some economic benefits and incentives for them to do that, you know, and it was really grabbing hold at a time when oil costs had risen and almost beyond reach for some of the Latin American countries.
Pam, what kind of legal strategy is possible to counter these killings and this wave of repression?
There are several possibilities. One of the things that's happening now is that as a result of the post-coup negotiations, the Lobo de facto government agreed to establish a truth commission. Now, that truth commission has been widely criticized because it's limited in the scope of violations it's looking at. It also limits itself in terms of its obligations to provide actual information and documentation of what happened during the coup for a period, I think, of 10 years. Human rights groups have criticized it. I think the Inter-American Commission has criticized it. So what the resistance has done has worked to set up an alternative to that commission, which will try to have a much more comprehensive approach and look at what actually happened, what led to the coup, how did the coup happen, and what has flowed from it, all of the rights violations.
And will that be done locally, or will it include international groups?
It includes international commissioners, actually. They brought, and in fact, they were very clear that it needed to involve others, you know, outside of Honduras because of the risks to folks living in Honduras right now. So that was key. And it was launched on June 28th, and their work is underway. That's one thing that's happening. The other possibility is that, of course, folks in Honduras are using, you know, their recourse to the Inter-American Commission. The Inter-American Commission has been watching this from the beginning. The resistance and members of, you know, the group of lawyers who've been working on this have, you know, testified before the commission. And so there's an ongoing dialogue there. The International Criminal Court is an actor that could investigate and potentially prosecute some of these acts. And then, of course, here in the U.S., you know, we do have the Alien Tort Statute, which is another vehicle for bringing human rights claims, albeit in U.S. courts.
Explain that for our audience, will you please?
The Alien Tort Statute is a very old law, dates back to 1789, I believe, that allows non-citizens to bring suit in U.S. courts for violations of international law. It really began to be used for human rights claims in the 1980s, in a case that's called Filartica v. Peña. It was the first attempt to use this as a forum when there were absolutely no other mechanisms of accountability for this family whose son had been tortured and murdered by a police official in Paraguay.
And they caught the bad guy in the United States. That's why jurisdiction was here. And I remember two of the attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Rhonda Copeland,
and right. Peter Weiss.
Right. Rhonda and Peter were able to bring that case. Yeah, the perpetrator he fled from Paraguay. He was considered a liability to the Stroessner regime, and he was found here in New York. And they found this law, and they were able to use this law to bring this case. And that set in motion, that sort of opened the door to these types of cases to be brought in the U.S. And remember, this is in the 1980s. It's before the International Criminal Court. Of course, we had the Inter-American Commission, but, you know, the Commission and the Inter-American Court involve cases against states, not individuals, and so there's not individual liability there. So this was really, you know, the only way to have some sort of accountability and to have the family, to have their voice be heard in all of this. So,
I'm curious, going back a bit to the journalists, are the journalists responding with fear or are they continuing to write about what's happening?
The courage shown by all sectors of this resistance is just incredible. I mean, and we're over a year out from the actual coup, and they have maintained such solidarity and such commitment to reform in the face of, you know, this eroding concern among some in the international community, and that's where I think the role that the U.S. played in all of this really has an impact in terms of somewhat quickly moving to recognize the new government and trying to pressure other countries in Latin America to do the same. But to answer your question, the journalists are continuing to write. There are sometimes people have to go into neighboring countries for safety, but all members of this resistance it's really impressive when you consider the struggle.
Attorney Pam Spies from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Let me ask you, if I might, more of a personal question. I know you just started working with the center this past January. And what was the road you took that got you into law school and eventually with the center and the kind of interest that you have now? How'd you get to where you are?
I'm glad you asked that question because it brings Rhonda Copeland into the room. I had actually, at one point, I thought about going to law school, and then I had dismissed it. I thought it's too hard to hold on to your politics if you go through, you know, into this 3-year battle, you know. So I had sort of decided against it, and then I discovered the City University of New York School of Law, which is, you know, was from the ground up, it was dedicated to the public interest, and I felt like my politics would not be harmed. In fact, they might be challenged in a good way there. And I found out about it through reading about the International Women's Human Rights Clinic that Rhonda set up there with Selena Romani. So that brought me out of Louisiana, which is where I had grown up, to New York.
Kidding.
Yeah. It was quite a wild ride. And I got to work and study with Rhonda, and then we became very close colleagues and friends after that. After law school, I was working around the establishment of the International Criminal Court with the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice, the mission of that organization was to bring a gender perspective to that process and to leading with the concern that rape and other sexual violence are going to be codified as egregious war crimes and torture and crimes against humanity. But there was a much broader political perspective involved in that as well. In that process was working around international criminal law and international women's human rights pieces, and quite often with Rhonda, and quite often it brought me into contact with folks at the Center for Constitutional Rights. So I've always admired the work that the Center was doing, and then certainly after 9/11 when CCR was sort of out front taking, at a very scary time, was taking some really brave steps to counter what was happening in terms of the erosion of the whole concept of rights. And I had gone back to Louisiana at a certain point, and I was doing criminal defense work there, sort of experimenting with, is it possible to bring this human rights concept, you know, to a more local level as well? And then last year, Rhonda started talking to me about maybe it's time to come back to New York. So,
when you say you were afraid that you're going to abandon your politics in law school, describe to me what your political visions are.
Well, what they were at that time and how they've, you know, developed since then is, you know, that's a story in and of itself. But, you know, I guess I was concerned. And at that moment in time, and in my early 20s, I was just, you know, sort of feeling my way around and had a lot of questions around what is the progressive approach to understanding the gender issues that we were facing and dealing with, certainly in Louisiana. So I was leading with that, but and when I say progressive approach, I mean, you know, so often women's human rights issues and advocates can be sort of pigeonholed, and you know there has to be a way to bring your larger political perspective and have all of this harmonized in a way that does not run counter to your politics as much as they might be identified as left. And I don't want to be too simplistic, but that's something we're still struggling with. We've just had a long conversation about how do you position all of these concerns and have a principled and progressive approach when so often women's issues get co-opted by the right or overtaken and or used to further agendas you don't agree with. So,
if our listeners want to learn more about the Alternative Truth Commission with respect to what's going on in Honduras, how might they get that information?
There is a website that the resistance has going, and they can Google Resistencia. Or
you better spell that.
R-I-S-I-S-T-E-N-C-I-A.
CIA?
Yeah,
always paranoid here.
Yeah, and a resistance front Honduras, and they'll get to the website. There's a lot of information about what's going on there, just in general and on a daily basis.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for coming down to the studio, and we look forward to hearing about further developments in Honduran human rights over the next few months.
Thank you, and thanks for making this a part of your show. It's something we need to keep on the radar of everybody.
Nice to have you, Pam. Good luck.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.